Welcome to the Mug Meeting Summaries Podcast. I'm Gilbert Detilieu. Our March meeting's main topic was The Cloud, presented by Rob Kaiser.
A little bit about me. I'm a systems administrator. I'm doing a topic on the cloud, quote, quote. I'm just going to dim this a little bit. I can't. Oh. Yep, hold on. This is one of the problems. I'm going to have to restart. It's fine. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what the cloud is and all that stuff. You just noticed another NVIDIA kernel bug. If I use the dim the screen up or down, it just it hard locks. It completely hard locks. So we're going to solve all these issues by booting into Windows, as much as I dislike it, because I do have the presentation at least in a somewhat similar format under Windows. An SSD, it shouldn't take too long. So, the cloud. How many people have used, quote, the cloud in any form whatsoever? Just raise your hand, because I don't know how many. Okay, so most of people have used it. I just want to gauge how fast and how technical I'm going to go through this. So for those of you who don't know, the cloud is effectively an encompassing solution. And what that means is you basically can do whatever you want on it. Anything that you could do with a desktop or a server farm. The idea is that you can do it by paying them microfinance per use somewhere else. And slideshow. Woohoo! Okay, that's a little bit bigger. Horrible contrast because I had to export, but yeah, I was going to say. Anyways, full screened, it's a little bit better. Alright, so I'm going to go through what it is, why it's popular, what you should at least be aware of, how it's used, and then a little bit about EC2. I've been using EC2 for a while. Just a quick rundown of basics of how to create one. Nothing too technical. If you have any questions whatsoever, you have any comments, yell it out. That's the deal. I'm not going to stop really in terms of breaks or anything, just yell at me. I'm going to go over libcloud very briefly. For those of you, how many people have heard and or used libcloud at all? Nobody. Great. It is an Apache project. It is a Python library. And what it does is it, all these providers on the right-hand side over here, those are just some providers that have, quote, the cloud. They all use different APIs to control the resources that are there. And so what libcloud does is it actually wraps all those different APIs into one simple way, so you can programmatically access multiple providers and multiple connections per provider. That's that. It did do it. Yay! So, like I said, it's an encompassing platform. This is taken just basically from EC2. This is not by any means what services are there. There's tons more services. As you can see, there's all kinds of different databases. There's caches. There's content delivery, even, if you want to go there. So, because of how Amazon has set this up, or any provider, you're most likely going to have multiple data centers. So that's where content delivery comes in, because you can have it at two different places. They handle the routing. They handle everything like that. It just gets your data to the clients faster. Effectively, except Akamai uses caching as well. They'll ship a rack to somewhere, and they'll manage that. This is what Amazon's naming scheme is for those things. Most people have heard of EC2. Most people have used EC2 or Rackspace in terms of cloud, quote-quote. S3 is another popular one. It is simply data storage. It is bucket storage. I'll get into a little bit more about that. Not much. Woohoo! Yay for... That was supposed to actually highlight, but because I went to Windows, that's what I'm going to talk about, the ones that disappear. EC2, Route 53, and S3.
Blinking ones.
Yeah, we'll just do that. Yeah. Okay, so, yeah, horrible conversion. Anyways, quickly, why is it popular? Well, execs love it because, woohoo, cloud it. I'm hosted in the cloud. I can't think of any more, but honestly, and I've dealt with a couple people who have been, why don't we put it in the cloud? And even users who have gone, I want my data in the cloud so I can access it everywhere. Well, that does you squat if you don't know how to get to it. And in corporate networks, you really don't want that. Like, let's be truthful. I work for a development company now. We would not put our SVN tree in the cloud. What happens when that gets hacked or that? You get all kinds of intellectual property issues because some of the stuff we work with, we don't even have license to distribute. You take on a whole other risk. Deceptively low pricing is another way. Because it is per usage, you pay for what you use. So if you do absolutely nothing, you're not going to pay much. I mean, I pay roughly $15 a month for two different servers and DNS and other stuff. And so it's cheap for me because I don't use it that much. They charge you for everything. For example, if you have, if you decide you want a static IP address with them, that doesn't cost you anything. But they will charge you per gig, on top of other data transfer rates, a fee to run through that static IP address. They make money up the wazoo in microfinancing. That's how it works. So, yeah, I'll go into more details about that later. But it's popular because it's off-site. You don't have to worry about anything. They do offer an SLA. It's not great. I'll get into a little bit more failures later on. But basically, their service level agreement is if it's not up for 99.5 or 99.95% of the time, they will do the microfinancing for how much it's down, which, again, does you diddly if you're not using it that much. If you are using it as, say, your main site and you have massive servers on their network all the time, you might see $20, maybe, because the downtime at an hour, some of the instances, high-end instances, are going to cost you just under $3 per hour. It's down for, say, 2 hours. That is not much money that you're paying, and they'll only give you that back. So bottom line, unless you agree with the cloud provider on a specific service level agreement, if it goes down, you're not seeing anything back. You're going to see $20, maybe $40 back at most. And that's a downtime of an hour that suddenly you've lost. Your mail just goes somewhere else. Done. It is scalable. Whereas, say, you build a server room in an office, you have space for three racks, you get past that, you're just out of luck. You cannot go past that without upgrading hardware by getting better density. And this ties into off-site. You don't have to deal with air conditioning, you don't have to deal with power, you don't have to deal with noise, which can be an issue that I found out. that's all taken care of for you. There is a flip side to that. So it's easy to administer. Really thing that gets you, large internet pipes. Off of the free tier, which I'll go into, on Amazon, which is 600 megs of RAM, you've got one CPU, and about 40 gigs of storage, you have access to, it's on a shared machine, but that machine probably has 10 gig to it. And it will have 10 gig to the net. So you do an apt-get install blah, they have a cache locally for EC2. If it's not there, it will pull it at about 40 megs down. But that also means that you suddenly go, yeah, install X. Pook. You've just used 2 gigs, for example. Like if you install the desktop and it's not cached, it will go and find and it will download 2 gigs onto your machine from the net. You're paying for that. You're paying by the gig for that data. That went through. Like I said, per-usage billing. The flip side of the uncontrollable infrastructure is a disk dies. You can't just pull it and do a DD. There is absolutely no chance of recovery of data, period. If you haven't snapshotted it, it's gone. You can't control back power. These servers are battery backed up to a point, but that's shared battery backed up. So if you have specific things that are more important, you can't specify, I want more backup power to them. It's just not possible.
So did you RAID on there?
Yeah, that's great. RAID fails. And I'll get into details, but S3 is guaranteed to be there, whereas EBS, or Elastical Block Storage, has a failure rate. And Amazon is quite clear over, yeah, this will just happen and fail. You have to deal with it. That's part of why it's cheaper. It's true. For example, on the right-hand side, it'll cost you about $115 a month for a medium instance. That's insane for what they give you. That's 16 cents an hour. That gives you 4 gigs of RAM, 420 gig hard drive, and 2 CPUs. That does not include any data. that does not include IOPS to your hard drive, which they bill for. By if you're on an EBS storage, it's by 10,000 IOPS. They will charge you a microcent. So if you're heavy disk usage on that, if you're computing data on that, they will charge you for that because your hard drive, your EBS storage, is actually over the network on their internal side. They have a SAN somewhere that takes care of all their storage. But because the link between the stuff isn't, you know, infinite, they charge you for it. So if you leave one of these running and you forget about it, keep in mind, to register for Amazon AWS, you have to give them a credit card number. Which means you forget a medium instance running, you leave it for a month, you get a bill at the end of the month for about $120. That's one. Straight off the bat, they will let you start up 20 in each data center. So the other thing to keep in mind is if you get hacked, if this specific credential gets gone, you can get charged $800 a day for one data center if they decide to use it. So bottom line is don't get hacked. It will cost you. These are some of the people. These are some of the people that are publicly using AWS. There are way more people using AWS than... Rackspace is still less than, but AWS and Rackspace are the two popular cloud providers, quote-unquote. And honestly, there are 10,000 people and companies that use AWS that just aren't doing it publicly. You can see by the start of, like, the graph on the side that I pulled down, like, quite literally, it is the choice for startups because it's cheap. It's cheap to start up, and you can expect your prices to be somewhat reasonable for the scale that you're doing. So that's something that I grabbed off of CNN after looking up because I knew something had happened. But effectively, once in a while, Amazon will screw up. And it will kill everything that's running in a specific data center or region. This was in response to 2 years ago in April, there was a networking event where somebody messed up a router, and it routed data in the US East 1 data center to a backup link that then got saturated, and it just killed it. It was down, and it was down for about 3 days. 3 days of downtime, you're getting compensated based on what you were running at that time. But even at $2 a pop per hour, you're going to see at most $160. Congratulations, you've been down for 3 days and your mail has just gone into dev null.
Do you remember what companies were affected by that? There were some big outages.
That whole list.
All of them?
Minus PayPal, because they weren't there at that time. So Netflix, Twitter was read-only for a while. New York Times and the Wall Street Journal were parts of it were off. Not all of it, but parts of it. Twilio, obviously, because they're in the cloud. Amazon itself was affected because they use their own services. Makes sense. And tons of other people that just aren't publicly now saying, we use EC2. Take a guess. How many IP addresses do you think US East 1 has?
12.
No, serious question. Like, seriously, I'm just kind of curious. Throw a number out there.
You mean that they make available for people use?
That they have assigned to that data center, yes.
Internalers.
These are public V4 addresses.
4 million.
No. Think of... No. Another number, lower than that.
Class B.
Higher than... Hmm?
The Class B, 65536.
Higher than that.
Quarter million. Close. Half a million more.
That's how many usable V4 addresses they have that they've at least said publicly. I haven't bothered to look up the AS number on them, also because they use one AS number for all of Amazon, which means that they do some crazy routing, but there's no way to, unless they tell you, there's no way to isolate specific data centers. That's the total V4 space. That means that they're at 0.013% of all addresses are going into that one data center. That's a massive amount of addresses going into one data center. Massive. Doesn't seem like much, but it's massive. For comparison, take a guess. MTS. Not all stream, but MTS.
100,000.
More.
666.
666.
30,000. For each person.
That's off of their AS number off of yesterday I did this. That's for MTS all stream. Not Allstream. Allstream has many, many, many more. But MTS, here in Manitoba, that's what their AS number can publicly get.
What's the AS number?
AS number, if for people that don't know, is autonomous zone number. It's assigned by Aaron here. Effectively, it's companies or individuals who go and say, I want relocatable address space. So if I go to another provider, I can say, I still have this address range, route for me, and they'll do it. It's how the internet routing works on the global scale, is you use AS numbers and peer with specific people. So MTS has a peer with Bell, has a peer with Shaw, all this other stuff, and they basically say, I can route this address. That's what an AS number loosely is used for. So that'll give you some size of, this is just one data center in the eastern United States in Virginia. It's equivalent to all of MTS going offline. Not just Winnipeg, not just Brandon, not just Thompson or Selkirk, all of MTS just suddenly going poof. And keep in mind, we don't host things here in Manitoba. Yeah, we might host a few things, but we have a Google cache, and that's cool. How much stuff do you think is actually hosted in that data center? Tons. So when it goes offline, there's a really, really big problem. So that gives you some idea of the data centers that AWS has. Regions and groups I'll go into. Regions are on the left, groups are on the right. It's a way of subdividing. So regions are an actual data center that Amazon runs. So US East 1 was the original one that EC2 started with. It is located in Virginia, and that's the only one that I took the IP addresses from. Amazon AWS itself probably has about 1% of publicly routable address space, which is massive. When you think about how many people are given a slash A, like, nobody. But anyways, point is, it's massive. US East West 1 and 2 are located in California and in Oregon. AP stands for Asia Pacific. EU West is in Ireland. It's just in Dublin. Southeast in AP is, it's Singapore,
Asia Pacific.
Yeah, Asia Pacific, and they're in Singapore and Tokyo. And SA is South America, and that one has been up, I think it's in the last 6 months it's been up. It's in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Effectively, the groups are just groupings of machines in that given area. So it allows you to put all your eggs in a couple different baskets, effectively. If you want to be in the U.S. data center in the east, on the East Coast, but you want to have some reliability that failure isn't going to kill you, unless the whole data center goes down, A is not going to affect C, is not going to affect D. It also comes into effect when you use elastic block storage, which is a type of backing. That doesn't span groups. You create an EBS image in one group, it doesn't go to the next. You have to keep that there. S3 is different, but S3 is also a heck of a lot more complicated. So, an actual image to run on S3 is AMI. You can be public, paid, or shared. And for S3, it's split off into 10 meg chunks. I just looked that up today. You don't actually have to give a damn about it. You really don't. You say, I want to back it by S3, and it goes and does it in the background. It's either backed by S3 or EBS, like I've said. EBS will fail. S3 won't. S3 costs you.
Why is 10 meg chunks the actual cost?
No. That's simply, say, S3 has a file size limit of, I think, 5 gigs. For one file, it can be 5 gigs or under. This is just simply saying that an AMI, by default, if you use S3, will be split up into that. I'm assuming for performance reasons, but that could be anything. Contains an XML manifest file. How many people have used .deb and .rpm and created their own? Everybody here, probably, or a large number. Same kind of idea. It's just a manifest file. It gives you checksums. It gives you information about stuff. So Red Hat, Canonical, and Microsoft all provide paid images. Keep in mind that anybody can say you want to charge. So you can create your own product, you can set it all up in an image, you can then put it on the cloud, and then say to Amazon, I will let anybody in the world who's going to pay me this amount, and you can specify that amount, and you can specify that amount based on what kind of image they, the kind of instance they do, pay me this much money. And so Amazon acts as the middleman in terms of you getting paid. They pay Amazon, Amazon pays you for the use of that image. That's also how Microsoft and Canonical and Red Hat make their money. they just simply go, okay, we'll license this to Amazon, and that's done. Shared is another way for private. By default, if you upload an AMI, it is private. Only that account that uploaded it has access to it. You can also specify other people, very specific other people. It's a crazy unique identifier. Pretty much, you want to either use public or private. I mean, you can use shared, but it's not really popular. A little bit of information about the XML manifest file, what it includes, that kind of stuff. Keep in mind that the kernel is not actually shipped with the AMI. The kernel is a separate... So basically, an image consists of a flat file system. It consists of an XML manifest file with a whole bunch of information around it. And then there's a separate kernel. And that kernel, you can upload separately. You can upload your own kernel, and it'll run under KVM or Xen, depending on where you put it. And so what the XML manifest file does is, you see there, it's a default kernel ID. So all kernels are unique identifier. So you can specify, this image should be run with a Linux kernel 3.0.2 or whatever. And if somebody tries to run it with a 2.4 kernel, it will probably break, but it's possible. The point is, you can upgrade kernels separately of images and mix and match if you decide to. That's what I had there. So originally, I had more stuff, but that kind of went to heck. So I'm going to get right into quickly showing what can be done. So the registration process for this is anywhere from 5 minutes to 25. They will require a phone number of you, usually a cell phone. They will either phone you or text you, and a combination of that. I don't know whether I was randomly selected or whether it was everybody, but they phoned me after about 30 minutes of use. They phoned me up and said, hey, are you doing this? Yes, I'm doing that. Okay. So as much as they realize that it is very easy to get hacked, initially they do try and provide some level of security in that you steal your mother's credit card number, you punch it in, you do whatever, likelihood is you're going to get caught. So there is some protection that way. As you can see, I got that straight off of that website. Effectively, like I said, I'm just going to be talking about EC2 and Route 53 and a little bit of S3, but there's all kinds of services. Rackspace is different. There are all kinds of providers out there, everywhere. So this basically provides you a nice web interface for controlling all the products that Amazon has. It's Ajax-y. Don't try and run it under links. It won't work. I've tried. So up here you can select your region. I guess right now I'd set something up for my dad because he wanted a UK proxy, right? It's possible. Set up an instance. So you got instances, images, block storage, and security. I'm going to cover security a little bit, but not go into great detail. This is all specific to the region you're in. So it gives you all the regions. This is East 1, West 2, West 1, and the others fairly straightforward. As they keep adding data centers, they're going to keep adding this list. It just gives you more option as to where you want your machine to run. So if you go to instances, for example, it gives you all kinds of nice information about this instance. Keep in mind, that is a virtual machine. It's like if you had KVM running, it is KVM-backed. AWS is KVM-backed, which means there's a server somewhere running KVM, and it's running that as a guest operating system. So you get decent performance, not bare metal, but pretty close. There are providers out there, cloud providers, quote-unquote, that give you access through IPMI or another lightsup management way to run a kernel and operating system on bare metal, if that's what you want. If you need raw performance, it is possible. I wouldn't recommend it because their prices are outrageous, but it is possible. A little bit of information about this. Security groups are kind of a firewalling. They're group-based security, so you can set up a security group that filters everything but SSH. Your machine doesn't see that. You can run IP tables, you can run PF, you can run whatever you want. Nothing's going to come through that interface that isn't 22. Think of this as you've got a rack of servers, you've got a Cisco switch at the top, you've got a firewall on top of that that's running BSD. The security groups is the BSD. Nothing will even hit those servers that makes it through, right? There's the type. I'm going to go over types a little bit. Let's get to those as opposed to...
So, pricing. Everybody likes prices, right? So,
As you can see, the T1 Micro, which is what I run, which is what most people run to start out with, is 2 cents an hour. This is only for the privilege of running an instance. This does not include you connecting with an SSH console to it. Some of them get pretty expensive pretty quickly. So you can do the math. 24 hours, you can spend $50 on a machine. You can start 20 of them at a time per data center. So if somebody steals this, you're screwed. I'll get into what they actually have in the next slide. So, as you can see, Windows decides that their product is worth more, so they up it. So you get instance types. This is specific to Amazon. With other providers, they can be slightly different. With Eucalyptus and private clouds, you can control this. The T1 Micro, as I said before, has 600 megs of RAM, these are EC2 or ECUs. Because they have differential CPUs across their farm, they can't legally say CPUs, but they are basically CPUs. Two of them means that, yeah, you'll do cat proc CPU info, there'll be two. And they are Xeon processors. EBS-backed, and 64-bit just came in like a couple months ago, 64-bit for this size. Just for compatibility reasons, effectively.
You mentioned this.
I'll touch very briefly on it. Basically, I'm talking mainly about EC2 and about Amazon's services. Everything that's over here with all of these services, you can set up, apart from a few of them that are proprietary, as internal services. So if you want the flexibility to have scale from one machine running a web server to 200, with a decent server room, you can do that. And you can set it up so that it uses a standardized protocol so that you can use tools to control it. It's called private cloud. It's a massive industry. It's been booming for the last year. It'll continue to for the next year. And then it'll fail and crash miserably because everybody will be, why would I host this myself? I trust these guys, right? Yeah. Some basic stuff, extra large instances, which are like, as I said, a couple bucks. You know, get a decent amount of spec for them, but at the same time, you're paying for it. Keep in mind, for performance testing for a specific product I was testing, you can do rendering on these. The GPU instances and such, if you are a biomedical guy and you need to render some stuff, sure, makes great sense. If you set up the infrastructure to send your jobs to the cloud, scale it properly, you're only going to use a couple hours because you're going to have multiple instances, a couple hours. It'll be done a heck of a lot faster than 20 machines chugging away for 6 months. But you have to know how to manage it. Some of these are insane. Like, honestly, that means that that's a 32-core machine and has two high-end NVIDIA on it. You're paying $2 and, well, here. You're paying $2.10 per hour that you use that. Even for development testing purposes, that's not bad. I mean, you're going to spend 4 hours developing this product after you've test-bedded it, you're only spending $8.
How secure is it?
Depends on what your definition of secure is. No, I'm serious, because at different levels, it's different levels of security. So on the bare metal, it's not secure at all. If somebody, Amazon, has access to your data, period, because it's running as a virtual machine, they can see the file system unless you use disk encryption. They can definitely see your RAM. So if you're dealing with any legally sensitive materials, you have to use specific providers or have specific SLAs in place. Amazon provides, can't remember what it's called, but it's a government-side cloud that has much more restrictions on it, but it is legally protected, so Amazon techs can't go and look at your data. So bare metal, not secure at all. Upper layer, yeah, it's secure. You're running, say, a standard instance. If I start an instance, which I will in a second, it'll be secure. By default, you use SSH keys, which are public-private keys. If you put a password on the private side, you have to have the password and you have to have the private key. So unless somebody knows your private key and knows your password, or they're sitting in the middle between you and an SSL session and they can do some crazy magic, they're not going to get access to it.
How do they enforce that if you install S?
Because you use images. So effectively, what you're doing is,
if I go to EC2, I'll walk through this quickly. It's easier than... I say I want to launch an instance in Ireland. I can use the classic wizard. So you can select what kind... These are the AMIs, which I talked about. They're effectively all kinds of different instances that you can start. The star just means that it's Amazon's approved that whatever. You can also go to community AMIs, which in any given data center, there are thousands, tens of thousands. This will take a while because it pulls, to give you some sense, it's 5 megs of text data. So I'll get into a quick demo of a product that I did quickly. Caching that data, you have to, because you're talking about 5 megs. See, look at that. 4,000. That's just in Dublin, which is really not that popular. US East 1 has 20,000. And they range from all kinds of stuff, right? So really, when it comes down to how can they enforce that the security of your operating system isn't already been rooted, right? Like, you have a rootkit on an image? You can't. You have to trust the provider. Either you do it yourself and you upload it, which I'll explain a little bit, or you use an image that you trust. Canonical, Red Hat, all of them, like any provider, will give you that reliability. Canonical also provides community ones, which are also guaranteed, because it's the Canonical-backed techs who have uploaded it.
Okay, so they're you're not installing this. These are pre-installed, pre-configured, you're trusting.
Think of it as a tar of an EXT2 file system. It's not that, but it's similar. It's a file system. It's a flat file system that they've created, they've uploaded. You get to run, and you get to run it with a kernel that you choose. So, quick start. I'll just start one of these up. Say I want to select that one. Go. So, you get to choose the number of instances. You can start up to 20 in each data center right off the bat with a credit card. Even if you have a $200 prepaid credit card, it'll do it, and it won't charge you to the end of the month. You will get sued if you try and do that. So, again, you can choose what kind of machine you want to start. Just for demonstration purposes, I am not going to spend $2. but, yeah, I know. You can also choose the availability zone. Because I'm in EU West, there's 3 options. It's just internal to the data center, what I want. Spot instances are kind of cool. It's an Amazon-specific thing. It's basically a way of them filling up their data center all the time. So you bid on your instance. You say, I'm going to spend at most X amount. And as long as nobody else, as long as there's space, you're fine. As long as there's no space and somebody doesn't bid higher than you, you're fine.
Flying standby.
As soon as somebody bids higher, it will shut down.
Really?
Yes. So you have to have an application layer that takes care of managing, oh, this machine just shut down. So you need a scheduler on top of that, effectively. You can save massive amounts of money. To give you some sense of the prices, that's the current price for a T1 micro. Less than a cent. So less than 50% per hour. Higher instances will be a lot less. But this is the way that Amazon keeps their data center running at full capacity all the time, and they're always making money on it. They don't have dead space because people bid on it. I've never used it personally. I do know it's cheaper. I do know that it's available. But they do shut down your instance when your bid is no longer valid.
But you get, like, increments of 1 full hour, basically?
No.
It could shut down at randomly.
Yes.
They would warn you?
No. How would they warn you?
No notification.
Oh, but does the machine just get, like, powered off, effectively? Or is it just told to shut down now and it shuts down now?
It's an ACPI function call, so it's a shutdown now.
So it's a proper shutdown.
So it's you're working on something right in the middle of it, unsaved, you're just...
Yeah, that's the point of it.
Well, if you have shutdown scripts...
It should work, yeah. And they give you a grace period. So if your system hasn't actually shut down when they tell it to shut down after 30 seconds or a minute, they'll just cut the power to you. Effectively, it's not that because it's KVM, but it is kill that process effectively.
Yeah.
And you're just gone. So you could have shutdown scripts. The other way to do it is they're really useful for if you're running an application layer scheduler. The company I work for has one, and it's for rendering stuff. So that would make a lot of sense. If you're rendering stuff, or if you're computing the largest prime to whatever, you can do it by using an application scheduler to do it.
And that's what you make the company
makes. Yeah, that's what ThinkBox makes, but that's besides the point. You can use Boink or any other scheduler that you want. It just has to be above the operating system because it could just be yink, PowerCon. So I can start this instance. Gives me an option, the kernel ID. Remember how I said that you can match up a kernel? You can run whatever kernel you want, really. You can upload your own kernel. So if you design your own operating system, and you do it, it runs KVM. So yes, you can actually run it, and I've done it where it's simply, you know, basic C kernel that prints hello world straight to video memory, and it works because it's KVM backed. So if you want to do some really high performance computing with your own operating system, it is possible. I wouldn't recommend it, but it's possible.
So how does the system present the online storage?
Online storage.
Like basically, well, your instance, right?
Yeah.
You've got your kernel, and you've got theoretically your user land files, all that stuff. How does it present it to the OS? Is it just a big hard drive?
It's a hard drive. It's dev SDA, and it takes care of everything else. Your operating system sees it's a hard drive, just like your operating system sees that it's a network card, even if it actually isn't. Your user data is kind of a handy feature. It's basically at the end of rc.local for BSD folks. It's after system startup, after everything has completed booting, you can run a command. So you can tell your telecomputer to phone home after it's done booting, or to install something. Like if I do apt-get install blender-y, that should install Blender to the system after it started, without me touching it. Shutdown behavior, you can either choose stop, which keeps your data. Keep in mind this is not valid for reserve instances or the bidding, but this is a way that you can not get billed for it, but you get billed for storage, or terminate. And terminate means it's gone. It kills the instance and it deletes the block storage. That is usually the way you want it. The termination protection is simply because you can access Amazon programmatically through their API. So if you want to make sure, if you're developing, that you don't remove your, you know, production system, you can do it, which is handy because I've done that. Key-value pairs, mainly for any, it exposes it to the API. So if you want to, basically their unique identifiers and names and other values for this specific instance. Key pairs, this is where it gets interesting. Say if I create a new key pair, want to name it mug, create it. It takes a little bit. I'm pretty sure that runs in JavaScript, folks, because they don't want your private key. They don't want to have your private key for a second. That probably runs in JavaScript and just computes a simple public-private key and forces you to download it. So now I've got that .pem, that's my private key. It's already selected that for me. So if I go back, it's already selected that and continue on. I can select the security groups. Again, it's basically an overarching firewall. Here's a really simple example. You can say all these different things. They've got a whole bunch of presets. You can do it by ICMP, UDP, and TCP. I've got one that's open, simply because I prefer IP tables, and I prefer to be able to configure it manually. If you're not concerned about security, go with their default. Their default is locked down. It provides you SSH, and that's it. Which is
there any cost implications? Like you were saying, you're paying for network traffic.
Yeah.
Like if you're filtering with IP tables as opposed to having them filter through a security group, is that going to affect billing?
Yeah. People, if I was filtering and I decided I'm not running a DNS server and it my IP somehow got into people's name servers, any traffic that they send me, I would be paying for it whether or not I respond because it's going through the network to me. So,
but if the security group filters it, then you don't get billed for it.
Exactly.
So that's a reason for doing it.
Yes. The downside is you can create one all you want. You can modify it even in real time. That's great. Perfect. Right? Why wouldn't you do that? Well, because you cannot remove and add security groups in real time to an instance. So you have to create one per instance if you want to have that layer of flexibility. Effectively is what that means. Summary page, woohoo, yay, simple enough, and do it. So in Dublin, it's launching. It could take a little bit of time, blah, 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 they give you all kinds of nice details. If I go to my instances, I have Dad's proxy running, great, and this thing's starting. What? I use this Tim's card all the time, and it's 2 cents an hour. At the end of the day, $15 a month for a proxy in the UK for specific things, it's not bad. I wouldn't want to run Netflix through this. Like, that's the thing. I've thought about using, like, EC2 to use as a proxy. It's great if you are only doing low-traffic stuff. Yeah. If we go back to the pricing, reserved instances, heavy utilization, spot instances, here you go, data transfer. Take a look at that. First gig, nothing. Up to 10 terabytes, you're talking 12 cents per gig. You watch a movie,
on Netflix, high definition, that's probably 2 gigs. It forces you to get up to at least $120 before the next pricing comes in.
Per month, yeah.
Is that also with the instance?
Yeah, the free instance effectively gives you a specific rate. Like, it gives you, I think, 10 gigs free, but after that, you still pay for it.
So even for streaming video, that's not cost prohibitive. That's
no, for streaming video, it's reasonable, but I wouldn't do it just simply because I will pay for that as opposed to paying for my instance in some respects. I mean, 12 cents a gig, suddenly it means that to watch a Netflix video, I'm paying 50 cents. I can find other ways to get around that. Again, gig per month provisioned. Whether it's all zeros or whether it's filled with all your important data. And per million IOPS. It wasn't 100,000, Edwin, it was a million. Sorry. So if you are disk thrashing it, you're going to pay. So, elastic IPs. These are basically static IP addresses, and I'll show you that right here. I'll say I want elastic IP. I say, give me an address. I want to use it in EC2. There's my address. I can say, associate it with what? I want it to be that new instance. Great, it's done. That is a static address that until I release it, or until Amazon decides that it really hates me and it's going to cancel my account, is mine. So I'll show you in a second or two that I actually use these as A records for DNS, because they're not going to change. Unless I release them, or unless Amazon cancels my account, they're mine. So this, and you can associate them to specific instances. That incurs another charge. Oh, sorry. Yeah, go for it. Try it. I guarantee it. Yeah. By default, it's SSH only, and it's SSH with passwords disabled. You need the private key that I just downloaded. It's not going to work. Remapping. It's free for the first... Basically, it's free for standard stuff. Don't hog IP addresses. They'll bill you. And don't remap them constantly. That's the idea. Other than that, they give you that. Now...
I guess you wouldn't want to have a torrent.
No. Your bandwidth would be through the roof, and you might get a nice letter from the Department of Justice in the U.S.
That's
going,
what
whatever. Yeah, exactly. Might get, you know, sued a little bit. Yeah.
These are images, actually. You've created an instance of an image.
Yes.
What about legacy systems? Like, is it all current stuff, or is it...
Definition of legacy is what?
Well, it's Windows 2000.
No.
Okay, so it's not appropriate for legacy users who have massive infrastructures built to only run on that particular operating system?
Not likely.
Okay.
Windows is tricky. You can get Windows on a private cloud. You have to hack around, and you're almost guaranteed to break licensing. The only way to get it... Yeah, I mean, Windows has it set up with Amazon AWS, where you can pay them a certain amount for specific things. Like, if I go to... create an instance. I'm pretty sure they only have newer ones. Yeah, they only provide you with the server side.
Okay, that's fine.
I'm pretty sure I've saw an O3 around, but it's only the server side. They won't allow you to use desktop OSs. So, let's do this. Look at the bolded text there. This is what people have designed now. That's the point of it. The point is to plan for failure on the cloud. So Chaos Monkey, I'll just read this out. The Chaos Monkey's job is to randomly kill instances and services within our architecture. This is coming from a Netflix architecture guy. Netflix runs in Amazon. 99% of what they do is in the cloud. Their system is designed with redundancy in mind so that they can withstand failure, because it will happen. When you're dealing with this kind of hardware and this kind of abstraction from the bare metal, it's going to mess up one way or another, whether it's networking, disk failure, or some communication protocol in between. So Netflix actually created a program called Chaos Monkey that effectively goes through the list of these things, images that it's running, and just either messes with it a little bit, like turns off networking, or it just kills it. So it can deal with all this failure all the time. And if you're dealing with it all the time, your system better be reliable enough to keep it running.
Where this sort of system becomes really attractive is if you're in like a service, like with Netflix or anyone else. Like if you've got like 5 users, you have 50 million in one day, turn a bunch on, right? So it's elastic computing. Be like, I'll give you now $50,000 today, deal with my Slashdot effect, and and then go away after.
Yeah.
And so
do they provide a service to
load balance? Yes.
Periodically.
Yep. Load balancing. Right there.
The extra charge.
Yes. Exactly. Exactly. That's how this works. The load balancer has to work with an Elastic IP. And you get a charge per gig that runs through the load balancer.
So double.
Pretty much, yeah. And basically this adds up to a lot of money when you're load balancing. A lot. For example, let's see if I can get the pricing. Auto-scaling load balancing. Look at that. Per hour, no matter how much you use, it's 2.5 cents. Not bad, except that you're getting charged per gig as well. So say you're Netflix, you're probably using load balancers, you're probably paying 90% of your cost in bandwidth and load balance.
And is that networking load balancing, or will they spin up other...
This is networking. This is networking load balancing. There is a service so that if you trust Amazon to look at the load on your server, which most people don't, you can set it up so that if it detects your server's under high load, you can specify an image, and it will spawn up X number of them given the load.
I thought that was one of the common uses.
Yeah.
I run all of my stuff on my own data center, but when I really get nailed at these other systems...
Exactly, yeah.
To sync
up, yeah.
To handle.
It's called CloudWatch, I believe, in here. Yeah. And it's another cost. Go figure. They charge you to look at your own, to graph your server and to give you all these alarms and metrics and to automatically spin up new instances given load or given whatever metric you want to put in. So it allows you to do literally like the slashdot effect. So you don't have to touch a computer if you get slashdotted because it'll do it all. It'll scale up your web servers and put a cache in the front. Just pay the bill. You also probably don't want to let this thing loose, because if you get DDoS'd,
yeah,
you're paying for it, because Amazon doesn't care what the data is. It cares that you're using it. So you will get charged. Unless you do this right, it'll charge you.
Got a few minutes left.
Yeah. So that was the coding horror that I wanted to touch on. This is the CloudGov little bit. It's a region. Effectively, you're running IBM, and... it's legally bound in certain ways so that government can use it in the States. There is no Canadian data center for Amazon, so if you are at any point working in a situation where you're working with the government or for the government, you can't use legally Amazon stuff because any document or any piece of information you've sent out of the country is breaking the law if it's considered private. It can't be done. Well, that's an arguable political point, but yes, Amazon will bend to any request by any agency in the States because that's where they're located. Or if you want hosted in the UK, you're bound by UK law. All that stuff, legalities. So I'm just going to show you very briefly. It's 9:45, so take a vote. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15. Who's for five? 10 minutes.
You mean more?
Yeah, how long am I going to keep talking? 15.
Right in the middle.
All right, so we're going to go with probably 7. So the instance that I created is right there. Great, I've got this machine. It's paravirtual and, yeah, all this other stuff. So I'm going to go down here, public DNS. I'm going to copy that. Copy. So this is required if you're running Windows because you get the .pem file, which is not PuTTY encoded. Yay for PuTTY. As much as it's great, it's a pain in the ass. I want to load the last thing. There we go. Mug. And so you import it. You then save the private key. Yes, I don't care. Mug. So that's saved. So now you can go back to PuTTY, which I didn't load originally. You can give it that address, or better yet, I go to my Elastic IPs, which I associated, right? I can type in that IP address. I can set up DNS, which I'll show you very briefly, very, very briefly about. But the point is, you load your SSH key in, the one that you just saved, and you connect. Woohoo! And by default, Ubuntu stuff is Ubuntu. So, great. Type in the username. If you have a password on your private key, you'll have to type it in. But there's the machine. It is literally, you've got sudo as well, but obviously. There's a machine. Woohoo! I believe the user data had Blender to install Blender, right?
Yeah.
Didn't do it. So if I look at var log.
Don't know if you ended up saving it.
Oh, yeah, I might not have. So if I take a look at the boot.log. Starting up, it generates the key, and that's all that has, apparently. It does show you a lot more information. Yeah, it might be in dmessage. So you can see this actually boots the Linux kernel. So if you write your own kernel, it does show up there. Doesn't do anything. It is ext3. It is an SDA device. You can add devices afterwards. So you can add your data to wherever if you want. I'm going to skip most of this. But you get an internal IP address. So that never changes. You can associate other addresses with it. Amazon can move you around in the data center in the availability region that you specified.
So it maps your public IP to internal IP then?
Yeah. It provides a layer of abstraction so that your VM can be moved around machines. So say this VM rack caught on fire or there's a networking issue. It'll automatically move your stuff somewhere else. And for the most part, it works well. And your machine doesn't know the better because the MAC address stays the same as those IP address. Any traffic coming in here, like if I do a... That's all my SSH traffic. It seems to be coming from this address, even though I don't know what the hell that is. That's the internal address to Amazon. There's that. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to make this really quick. The other thing I said I'd talk about was Route 53, which is what I use. It's DNS. It's cheap. There is pricing somewhere. Anyways, while that's going. So you can load zones. Click on zone. Great, I've got argylemachine.net. Gives you a unique identifier, and you set your NS records to the NS servers it tells you. These are distributed, as you can see. One's a .co.uk, one's .net, one's .org, one's .com. Presumably, they're in four different data centers, so that at all times, my DNS will work. If you go to record set, you can set up records just like you would anything else. You can modify them, all that stuff. You can also do weighted sets for specific types of addresses, right? So A, you can have multiple A records, and DNS will automatically load balance. You won't be paying Amazon for that. So if I create a record set, again, you can specify whatever, and it works. It's DNS. It's nothing special. They charge you per request. So if you get denial of service, yeah, you're screwed. But at the end of the day, you have to think that it's going to be cached. Because they'd have to go back and figure out what your NS record is. They'd have to actually want to. But they can do a dig NS, argylemachine.net, figure out those are the name servers, dig at those name servers, and I'd pay for it. But if you do a standard dig, you'd be, from my home, for example, if I did a dig, I'd be going through MTS, and MTS would cache that. So they really have to want to do that, but it is possible. And it's cheap. Let's see what this... That gives you some sense for a zone per month. Yeah, like it is a cost, but you're not going to pay for this service in the standard way. I mean, compared to that you don't need to, but usually it's used with Amazon. So compared to my EC2, it's nothing. It's cheap.
Prorate.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's per query.
Per query, yeah.
But once they start...
They'll be cached, just like DNS is cached. So if somebody from MTS... queries it.
Somebody looks for you, but once they start getting the information off your site, that's even more money?
No, because of how DNS works. If I want to get to Argyle Machine, I say, MTS, find me Argyle Machine. MTS goes and bubbles up. It hits my DNS server once, then it gets cached to MTS. So
usually cached for a date.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it won't hit my server again until that cache expires or until somebody from another network goes up. So it's cheap at the end of the day. Is there anything... I haven't touched on a lot of stuff that I wanted to, but there's no time, and honestly, people want to get out of here, that's fair.
So assuming you're going to shut the whole damn thing down right now, how much does this will cost you?
2 cents an hour, plus the IP at whatever that was, which is, I think...
Like $3.
No. Try, like... for this instance, to start up and to show you, it probably cost me 5 cents.
Have a nice dashboard showing the meter going.
There's all kinds of stuff like that. But
that wouldn't be in their best interest.
Yeah. So if I terminate
that
your bank account is, yeah.
Great. It did that. It works. Woohoo!
So with the library, you're actually able to set up a local encryption to use libstuff locally and actually tell these different cloud servers?
Yeah. This is the last thing I'm going to do. It's going to be very, very quick. I'm just going to show you. I got permission to do this, thankfully. This is work in progress. I'm in the process of making it a little bit better, of rewriting it with doc strings. I wrote a Qt library, a Qt application that used libcloud, and I wrote it introspectively so that I could upgrade libcloud in the back end, and features will appear in the GUI. It also wraps every provider that libcloud supports, which is currently 20-something. So effectively, it's an application. You can control the cloud. You can control whatever cloud you want, private, public, anything, and it upgrades as you upgrade libcloud. Right now, for example, it's building the cache. You'd think it's doing something, and a previous iteration had this nice splash screen saying, here's what I'm doing. Effectively, it's pulling down 5 megabytes of data because that's the cache for US East 1, just the plain text of all the available images, all the available AMIs. It takes a long time. Hey, see? Look, poof, done. So you can see, those are the instances, just like on this website, because I have it set up with mine. I'm connected to US East 1, and you can query all this stuff, whatever. And, this is East 1, so it's not the one that I was showing you, but you can set that up easily. I'm not going to do it, but you just go into here, you specify whatever, and you specify your credentials. But point is, libcloud, if you're working programmatically with the cloud, I highly recommend libcloud, because it programmatically can handle multiple providers. Whereas every other provider, you'd have to either know the protocol or know the API, or you'd have to create libcloud effectively. You have to create a wrapper class to do everything. So, any questions? Because I am running out of time and I said I'd be done.
Yeah? I'd like to know, when I was considering this type of service for moving some services out of our centers,
yeah.
Are there some services that you find this is in a typical, say, regular business network, are there some services you move out of there because it's cheaper here?
No.
Still not that.
File servers, you have to pay for bandwidth in and out.
One thing we've considered was firing up an instance to run our server.
You're paying traffic. Any attachment is going to be billed with bandwidth. So it depends on your bandwidth. Sure, it works. It'll cost you. It won't cost you an arm and a leg, effectively, but it'll cost you.
And potentially move the cost of the bandwidth to our actual office, because we're not taking all that mail traffic, taking it after the filter, which happened there, and it's mail,
yes.
So the privacy part...
Except the kicker is that if I'm Joe Schmoe, I send an email to somebody inside your company, you're paying for the bandwidth from my SMTP server into yours in the cloud.
Yeah.
You're paying for that. So even if it gets filtered out, you're paying for it.
Yes.
You're paying twice if it goes through.
Mm-hmm.
So
in and out.
You are going to be paying for it. Regardless of... So if I send you a 10 meg attachment, it gets filtered out, you're going to be paying for that.
I guess not really the cost that's really the issue. Really. The real benefit comes down to being able to actually have a very low infrastructure cost.
Yeah.
From a business standpoint, and actually easily deploy it and just rack up your requirements. And it depends on your business needs, right? So the cost may be significant from that standpoint, but it makes no difference. Really. You're saving all the upfront cost, right?
And that's the reason why that...
You don't have to maintain the hardware. You need a little bit less bandwidth in place, but is that enough to balance out the cost?
Same as software as a service.
Yeah.
Where is the business bandwidth?
Yeah.
Licensing for Windows is a lot. It's basically a third
really
of the cost for instance,
cost.
Again.
Is that hard part?
Just to run Windows.
But you can play with it.
But yeah, that goes to speak as to... This is just rough figures from Elastic Security, which is a cloud-based stuff. But it is used. When a data center has an issue, you notice it. Whether or not you use these services, because likelihood is, at some point, you're going to be hitting a site that includes a link to a CSS file that's hosted somewhere. It makes up a lot of the web traffic. Akamai and AWS and Rackspace account for, I think it was 40% of the worldwide traffic, something like that, because Akamai is the content delivery, right? And then you get the back end of that, which is cloud-based. So, anyways, that's all I have. So.
Thank you, Rob.
That's it for this podcast. Thanks for listening.
For more Mug Meeting summaries or for more information about the Manitoba Unix User Group, check out our website at muug.mb.ca.